Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, we continue our series about the largest animal processing plants in the world. Yesterday, we talked about JBS and Smithfield. Today, we are focusing on Tyson and Cargill. Tyson Foods is one of the largest meat producers. According to Sentient Media, Tyson Foods produces 20% of the United States' chicken, pork, and beef products. Tyson slaughters 37 million chickens every week in 50 facilities. And they are one of the biggest suppliers to fast food chains like KFC, Taco Bell, Burger King, and McDonald's. Tyson owns the brands Jimmy Dean, Hillshire Farms, Sara Lee, Nature Raised Farms, and many others. Last year, Tyson Foods saw $42 billion in sales and made about $2 billion in profit, according to the company's self-reported numbers. In 2016, a report from Oxfam alleged that Tyson's chicken processing plant workers were forced to wear diapers on the line because they were routinely denied bathroom breaks. And according to the latest numbers from the Washington Post, this just came out 2 days ago, the coronavirus has exploded from less than 1,600 cases a month ago to more than 7,000 today. So this is Tyson employees who have tested positive for COVID-19, according to a Washington Post analysis. Joining us to talk about Tyson is Peter Waldman, an award-winning reporter for Bloomberg. Peter writes about politics, business, economics, and social issues. And one of his latest pieces for Bloomberg, which you can read at Your Call Radio, is called Cold, Crowded, Deadly, How U.S. Meat Plants Became a Virus Breeding Ground. Hi, Peter. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's great to have you back, Peter. First, I just want to ask you, these are huge numbers according to this Washington Post analysis. 7,000 Tyson employees have tested positive.
Yeah, well, it's typical of meatpacking generally. We know that the virus rampaged through meat plants throughout the second half of March and well into April at a time when few of the plants were doing a whole lot to stop it. Their attitude seemed to be that the virus itself, COVID-19, the illness, was less serious perhaps than many of the hazards faced on a daily basis by meatpacking workers, and they didn't take it too seriously.
And throughout the industry, according to the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, worker deaths have tripled, surging from 17 to at least 63. And according to Business Insider, 18 of those deaths have been linked to Tyson Foods. You know, Peter, what are your thoughts about this cycle that we're seeing of these meat plants seeing outbreaks, closing, saying that they're doing some kind of deep cleaning, and then opening again?
Well, it doesn't appear that the reopenings have stemmed the virus all that much. The one thing we can say is that the companies are focused on it. They realize they had quite a bit of exposure and liability in a way because once the pandemic got out of control at the plants and in the local communities, just as importantly, local and state health officials brought a lot of pressure to bear in some jurisdictions anyway, not all, but some. And that was very uncomfortable and threatened the continued operation of the plant. So even if you had always, let's say historically, seen your meatpacking workers as somewhat dispensable, somewhat replaceable, almost like interchangeable parts in a factory assembly line, suddenly they weren't replaceable. Suddenly they had their illness, their health status had the effect of shutting you down. So they've become much more aware and concerned about it and have actually done a lot of serious upgrading, one might say, things like putting in plastic shields between workstations and trying to monitor on entry to the plant. But the jury is still out as to how effective.
Peter, you're cutting in and out. Are you moving at all, or is that just your line?
I'm not.
Uh-oh. You know, why don't we, let's try to call Peter back. Does Peter have a landline, do we know?
Yeah.
Hmm. Do you have a landline, Peter?
I do.
Okay, great. Now I'm hearing myself. Kevin, there we go. Can you give Kevin your landline and we'll call you right back?
Sure, thanks.
Great. Thank you so much. Sorry about that. We're not in the studio right now. I'm hosting the show from my kitchen and all of our guests are doing the show from home. And so actually we've had a pretty good track record with phone lines, but this one was pretty bad. So we're going to call Peter back on his landline. You know, just talking about cleaning up these slaughterhouses, Peter actually wrote a piece about this a couple of years ago called America's Worst Graveyard Shift is Grinding Up Workers. Cleanup at the slaughterhouse is as dangerous as it is repulsive, and the immigrants who do the work are under pressure to complete it faster than ever. And when we were calling up Peter, I'll just read from his piece because these plants say that they're closing to do a deep clean. We're not really sure what that means, but it is important to say that someone is doing that cleaning. We just did a show about janitors a couple of weeks ago. These are people who are on the front lines. So I'm just going to read from his piece and then we'll reconnect with Peter. He writes, "No one knew her real name. At work, she was Tiffany Cisneros until her arm got crushed in a conveyor belt. She filed for workers' comp as Martha Solorzano, born 1966. The doctor who evaluated her wrote down her last name as Torres. We'll call her Martha. Like millions of undocumented immigrants, Martha lived in the shadows. She slept by day, worked at night, shifted names as circumstances demanded, and supported her family with scraps that fell her way from the labor market. She worked as a cleaner on the graveyard shift at Tyson's meatpacking plant in Holcomb, Kansas. Every day, up to 6,000 cows clamber off 18-wheelers lined up at the facility. They're watered, then ushered into the kill box, knocked unconscious by a bolt gun, hung upside down with their hearts pounding, and bled to death by a slash to the jugular." Well, that's pretty intense, but that's exactly what goes on in these slaughterhouse plants. And somebody's got to clean this up. And so Peter has written about the workers who work these graveyard shifts cleaning up these slaughterhouses. And I think we have Peter back. Are you back now, Peter?
I am.
Okay, I think that's going to be a much better line. Thank you. So I was just reading from the piece you wrote a couple years ago about the people who work these graveyard shifts cleaning up these slaughterhouses. As you write, this is repulsive and very dangerous work. We've been wondering, when these plants say they're closing to do deep cleanings, what does that mean exactly?
So it means that they're doing exactly what those sanitation workers try to do on a nightly basis. They're just doing it more intensively. The question is, it's not the surface areas, it's not the contact with inanimate objects which is getting people sick, it's the proximity people, the workers have to one another. So you can do a deep cleaning literally screw by screw throughout an enormous meatpacking plant, but it doesn't mean that you will protect the workers from the virus, which they're getting from one another. So to prevent it from spreading between and among workers, they're putting in plastic shields between workstations. But mind you, people are working shoulder to shoulder, cutting up bits of meat, coming down an assembly line at faster and faster speeds, at least going over the last year or two, the speeds have been speeding up. So that has meant closer proximity of workers, and these plastic shields are unlikely to do a lot of good. What everyone has said who's looked at this, and thus from an industrial hygiene point of view, these workers need to be spread out on the line so that they have social distancing as the rest of us do, or we might call it professional distancing of 6 feet, and maybe they won't cough or breathe on one another and spread the virus. If you're going to spread the workers out, you have to slow down the lines, and that's where the rub comes in.
Right. That's where the rub comes in. And we've been covering this industry for years now, a lot more because of COVID in the past few months. But we've been talking about the fact that these companies are trying to speed up the kill lines, Peter, which makes it impossible to physically distance.
Absolutely. The assembly lines have been moving faster and faster. the Obama administration balked at permitting them, the Department of Agriculture and OSHA agencies which needed to sign off, balked at that. But with the change of administrations, the rather powerful lobby of the meatpackers, these are enormous companies that wield a lot of clout, and you can imagine have a lot of Congress people supporting them in agricultural states, they've brought pressure to bear on the Trump administration, which has been only too happy to allow for increased speed on the assembly lines. And that, by the way, has its own set of implications for the health and safety of workers, from exposure to all kinds of other hazards from going so fast, particularly carpal tunnel syndrome and other repetitive use injuries. So that has got its own downfall.
To your point about lobbying, Peter, last month the New York Times ran a piece called Powerful Meat Industry Holds More Sway After Trump's Order. And it was about the executive order, which doesn't explicitly mandate that these meat processing plants stay open. But it says that the decisions around whether to close or open should be driven by the federal government, not local authorities. And the Times reports that the action followed weeks of lobbying behind the scenes and in public by companies led by Tyson Foods.
Well, Tyson is the largest U.S. meat packer. They control a huge percentage of the slaughter that takes place, and they have a lot of friends in Congress. They're based in Arkansas. And have generally been very friendly with the senators and congressional delegations there. But as well, you have to remember, they, as do all the large meat packers, have plants throughout congressional districts where their employment and their economic value to those districts and states is very, very high. You look at a place like Arkansas or some of the southern states, Georgia, Mississippi, and you'll see that in many towns, Iowa is another big one, where they have huge pork processing plants. Tyson, I think, produces something like 10% of the nation's pork supply, much of it from Iowa. And the political leadership in those places and in Washington is extremely supportive. So Tyson wields a whole lot of clout. It was their advertisement, their full-page ad run in newspapers throughout the country in April, which said the supply chain in the meat industry was breaking, that preceded and I would say prompted, precipitated the Trump administration's action to keep the plants open. And I think it was a lot of the Tyson pressure, Tyson influence that led to that executive order.
Well, what did you think about how the media covered that ad, Peter? Again, it said, quote, "The food supply chain is breaking. We have a responsibility to feed our country. It's essential as health care." It got so much media attention.
It did get a lot of media attention because Americans eat a lot of meat. Let's face it, the consumers are being given something that they want. There are two sides of every transaction, even when it just amounts to buying a pound of meat at the grocery store or a Big Mac at McDonald's. And consumers have increased their meat consumption and rely on meat that they can afford, the 99-cent burger or the, you know, $2 pound of hamburger at the store, at the grocery store. This is something the consumers have wanted, and that these companies have delivered by competing against each other to lower the price down, you know, down to the penny, the quarter penny in some of these big transactions when they're selling commodities or tonnage of meat and so forth. They are really, it's a race to the bottom. When that happens, it leads to what, you know, the efficiency game, which is all about size and scale, so that they can have 5,000 workers working shoulder to shoulder in these mega plants where disease, but not only disease, because it would be a real mistake for us to focus too closely on COVID and not think about the hazards and injuries, and specifically the amputations and carpal tunnel and stress injuries that this body of workers, there are 500,000 meat workers in the United States, so a lot of people. They tend to work in sort of less visible parts of our country where media is a little more scarce, in some of the rural areas and small towns of the South and Midwest. And they're the sort of, in fact, I would say the animal misery, what you were reading from my earlier piece, is probably better known than the human misery in those plants.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, we've been talking about that also, just about how so many of these people are immigrants at the Greeley Smithfield plant. No, JBS. The JBS Greeley plant in Colorado, they actually have a relocation program to bring immigrants to Greeley to work specifically for JBS.
So that's just a reflection of the fact that nobody wants to work there, and only the sort of destitute and desperate segments of our workforce in the United States are drawn to these places for employment. What you're describing are arrangements that the meat packers have with resettlement agencies who are helping refugees from places like Burma and Vietnam from previous times, Somalia. All the places that tend to, that used to, because of course the Trump administration has radically reduced the number of refugees from around the world coming to the United States, but the places where we used to take people from are supplying some of the labor in these meat plants. But don't forget, the plurality of these immigrant workers in the meat plants are still from Latin America and Mexico.
Hmm. To your point about how they're treated, Oxfam came out with a report back in 2016, and I'm reading from NBC News now. It says poultry workers are denied basic needs such as bathroom breaks to the point of being forced to wear diapers while on the line. As a result, employees restrict intake of liquids and fluids to dangerous degrees. They endure pain and discomfort while they worry about their health and job security. The conditions are particularly trying for women who are menstruating or pregnant. This cited unnamed workers who Oxfam interviewed over a period of 3 years.
Yeah, this is not unusual, what you're describing. It varies from plant to plant. Interestingly, as one gets into this industry, you see that it's more a plant, individual plant determinant of conditions, meaning that it's management and it's how things have been running in a specific place, or I should probably say a specific labor market, whether it's Mississippi or North Carolina or Pennsylvania, where I recently wrote about a plant. The labor markets and the plant management has more to do with the labor conditions in the specific plant than the company itself. So while all of these companies have notoriously callous labor practices, I would say some of them have plants that are much better than others. And another thing I would add here, and it may not be popular for saying this, but I'm not sure that unionism or union representation is necessarily the determinant of conditions. I think where unions do represent meat workers, and I think it's about a third of the plants, it may be even a little higher, conditions may be somewhat better. Wages tend to be better. Negotiated contracts tend to be better. Safety and health, not really.
Today we're speaking with Peter Waldman, an award-winning reporter for Bloomberg. One of his recent pieces is called Cold, Crowded, Deadly, How U.S. Meat Plants Became a Virus Breeding Ground. Today we're continuing our series about the largest animal processing plants in the world. Yesterday we talked about JBS and Smithfield. Today we're discussing Tyson and Cargill. Tyson is one of the world's largest meat producers. We're talking about chicken, pork, and beef. Tyson slaughters 37 million chickens every week in 50 facilities. Last year, Tyson saw $42 billion in sales and made about $2 billion in profits. This is according to their own numbers. If you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about these meat companies, their profits, lobbying, working conditions, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. 8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Let's talk about the history of Tyson for a bit, Peter. As you said, Tyson is in Springdale, Arkansas. It was founded in 1935 by John Tyson. Today, the Tyson family is one of the wealthiest in the U.S. They're valued at $2 billion, according to Forbes. They have more than 100,000 employees. And according to Sentient Media, they slaughter an astonishing 37 million chickens every week. How did they get so big?
Well, the same way that the other chains, whether it's JBS or Cargill, through acquisition. So there's been this tremendous concentration within the meatpacking industry. So you have really, you know, 4 to 6 major players now, the top 3 or 4 having a huge share of the market. And they have all participated in what I described before as the race to the bottom in terms of how you produce a pound of meat or poultry or pork, whatever, for the lowest amount of money. And to do that, they've bought up smaller suppliers. As with most things in the United States, we used to have regional suppliers, regional slaughterhouses that employed anywhere from dozens to a few hundred people and supplied a region where they didn't have to ship too far away. But as refrigeration and trucking and all the mechanisms of distribution changed over time, it allowed the meatpackers to amass more and more capacity so that they can have these now enormous plants. There are some upwards of 5 or 6,000 workers, and that tends to exacerbate all of the issues of hazards and safety and health that we've been discussing.
And some people might not know that they're buying a Tyson product because they have so many brands. I'll just name a couple. Jimmy Dean, Hillshire Farm, Sara Lee. I didn't know that Tyson now owns Sara Lee. Nature Raised Farms, a Mexican Original, a couple of dog treat companies, Top Chews and True Chews. This is one of, it looks like, about maybe 15 companies.
Yeah, you can hear from some of those names. I don't know the exact history, but I assume that some were these regional farmers. I don't know, Jimmy Dean's and some of the various types were, as was Tyson originally, of course, in Arkansas. These were regional suppliers, and the roll-up has just really accelerated. Let's give credit where credit is due here, or blame if that's what you call it. But it was interpretation of U.S. antitrust law by successive administrations, both Democratic and Republican, in Washington that allowed this to happen. So the view that has prevailed throughout many industries, but particularly in food and meatpacking, where price sensitivity is so important and it's hard to oppose lower food prices for the consumer if you're a political figure. But various Department of Justice antitrust offices or the Federal Trade Commission at various points have looked at these roll-ups, these deals, when the larger eats a smaller slaughter operation, and said, well, they've justified the fact that they can produce this more economically, and the concentration appears not to be anti-competitive, meaning that there's still whatever there were, maybe 20 years ago, there's still 20, or 10 years ago, there's still 12, or maybe now there are 4 or 5. Whatever it was, they were still dividing up the market, so none of them had a share that the antitrust enforcers viewed as excessive, or the technical analysis showed had an excessive market share, and they allowed it to happen. So these, where we are today with meatpacking is very much a reflection of federal policy.
Peter Waldman is an award-winning reporter for Bloomberg, and we're talking with him about Tyson and Cargill. According to Sentient Media, Tyson produces 20% of this country's chicken, pork, and beef products. Tyson slaughters 37 million chickens per week in 50 facilities. Coming up after a break, we'll talk about environmental destruction caused by these companies, and then we will talk about the company Cargill. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. Your Call, I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with members of Children of Smithfield, the sons and daughters of Smithfield meat processing plant workers. Nearly 18,000 meatpacking workers have contracted COVID-19. What will it take to get justice for these workers? And if you missed yesterday's show about Smithfield and JBS, you can find it at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about Tyson. In a couple minutes, we'll talk about Cargill. We're joined by Peter Waldman, an award-winning reporter for Bloomberg. If you have any questions or comments about these massive animal processing companies, we'd love to hear from you. Also, what are your thoughts just about, there's so much coverage about this because of COVID. All media outlets have been covering this on a pretty regular basis. So what stands out for you? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Just a couple more questions about Tyson, and then we'll move on to Cargill. Just to throw out a fact, Tyson has spent $17 million on lobbying over the past 10 years. They support lobbying groups that campaign against animal protection laws and against animal rights organizations. This is according to the Center for Responsive Politics. We already touched on that. I want to talk about environmental destruction from land to water use. Peter, according to Food and Water Watch, in 2014, Tyson dumped over 20 million pounds of toxic pollutants into U.S. waterways. Between 2013 and 2015, the company was guilty of more than 300 clean water permit violations. Tyson is called the number one polluter by Food and Water Watch. This is even in front of oil and gas companies.
It's hard for me to evaluate Food and Water Watch's numbers on that because I just haven't looked at the data. I will say as a general matter that agriculture, in particular animal husbandry and slaughterhouse operations, produce enormous amounts of effluents that need to be dealt with. I mean, if you can imagine hundreds and hundreds of thousands of, whether they're chickens, pigs, cattle, all in a very small area are producing manure at enormous rates that need to go somewhere. And I think what we're getting at here is the issue of where these plants choose to locate. They're obviously in places not only where the effluents and air pollution, because there's a lot of airborne stuff that comes out of them as well, they're in places where people will be less directly, and I'm not saying all people, but some people, and maybe people in more intensively covered media markets or areas with perhaps wealthier inhabitants, they will be less affected by those effluents than others. So you know, you're seeing these plants in across the Deep South, again, not necessarily completely away from people, because there are towns and the workers are living not very far away, but they go to places where the political strength of the local residents is less than is less powerful than that of the companies and the polluters themselves. So it's really their dream is to just be out of sight, out of mind, producing low cost protein that comes to your market and you're thankful for. The poor people, literally poor, but the sympathetic folks who have to live near those places pay a price in terms of asthma, in terms of water quality, in terms of air quality, you name it, across the board. And you see some pushback some places sometimes, but by and large, as I said, they're kind of welcomed in these communities. And when we talk about cargo, I'll tell you a story about that.
Well, we're going to be doing a show about that issue and how these companies affect water, land, and the connections to environmental justice. We're going to do that, I think it's in 2 Mondays. Before we start off our section on Cargill, we've got a couple of emails and phone calls about buying power. So let's first go to a caller. Let's hear from Julie in San Francisco. Hi, Julie. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm very familiar with Smithfield over the years because of the unions have been trying to resist them. My question is, as we slowly move to maybe more meatless eating, are there responsible producers out there of pork and meats that we should be looking at and using as customers?
Thank you for that. We have a similar question from Stefan. Peter, what are your thoughts?
Well, there are definitely more responsible producers. They're obviously smaller, which is very important because scale is what tends to breed the worst offenses. They're smaller, they command a premium for their product when people are willing to pay for it. So you'll find these brands in the higher end markets. There are a lot of now direct to consumer. You can buy chickens from suppliers over the internet, and they come in some form of preservation. I'm not exactly sure. We wrote about one in our last story. Cook Venture out of Oklahoma, which produces its poultry in a 200-person plant and has a farm where they raise poultry in far more humane fashion on a pasture and not in a coop. And these free-range chickens go to slaughter in a place where the workers are generally treated better and paid better. And it's an interesting COVID story because this supplier, Cook Ventures, was far more responsive to the onset of the coronavirus and essentially separated its workers, gave them PPE, in March when this thing was evident. And also, because it pays more, it found that their people were not living in overcrowded group housing, which is enormously important in this issue of coronavirus. So if they're making a living wage, at least for their local market, and they can afford a place where they live maybe only with their family and not many other workers, or only with one worker or two other workers and not with 12, they can sequester and isolate and do all the things, the social distancing that are important. And at least Cook Ventures was arguing that was a very important factor. So I think the caller is it's very important to ask that question, who out there can I purchase meat from who's treating its folks better? And they tend to be the smaller brands commanding a higher price for their produce.
Well, thank you for the call, Julie. Stefan also asks, what about Whole Foods-type places? They seem to offer clean options, but are we kidding ourselves when we rely on those stores, too?
Well, I believe there are some lines in some markets, possibly including Whole Foods. I'm not commenting on them directly, but where you can buy from smaller producers, maybe they're local. Sometimes these markets are emphasizing local sourced food, and almost always when you're sourcing locally, you're sourcing from much smaller operations, and you're paying more money. So whether or not, the typical thing you buy in Whole Foods is that, or whether if you are more discriminating and you ask the meat counter for something specific, you might be better off with the latter.
Thank you for the email, Stefan. We have another email from Lee who says, do the meat processing plants have public tours? Providing public tours, has that been considered as a regulation?
It's a really great question. You may know that it's become very difficult for journalists and others on what would we call them, possibly activists or the other kinds of folks who go into places and try to document stuff on their own so that the public knows what's happening. It's become much more difficult to do that throughout these plants and throughout most food processing in general. It probably says as much as you need to know. The large producers don't want people to know how things are produced. So there are tours in some Midwestern plants, I've heard. In fact, my description that you read of how they slaughter cattle was from an eyewitness account and some video of from a public tour. Whether that is still going on, I don't know. That was a couple years ago. So, but I think you're more likely to find a tour in a more isolated place where they're actually trying to make a little money, kind of like our own Napa Valley wineries.
Hmm. It's a great question, Lee. We briefly talked about this yesterday, about these ag gag laws, and they're passing across the country, but they're actually being struck down. Kansas's ag gag law was ruled unconstitutional just in January. So Vox has a piece about this, how they're being struck down. We should do a show about that soon. Thank you for the question, Lee. If you'd like to join us today, we are in the middle of a series about the largest animal processing plants in the country. Yesterday, we talked about JBS in Smithfield. Today, we are talking about Tyson, and we're going to move and talk about Cargill in a minute. If you have a question or a comment for Peter Waldman, an award-winning reporter at Bloomberg, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And now let's talk about Cargill, Peter. Cargill is the third largest beef packer in the U.S. Cargill is based in Minneapolis, and they're the biggest privately held company in the U.S. They reported $2.6 billion in net profit last year, $113 billion in revenue. They employ 28,000 workers at more than 36 facilities in the U.S. and Canada. In your latest piece, you honor Raphael Benjamin, who has worked at a Cargill pork and beef processing plant in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, for 17 years. You report that on March 25th, one of Raphael's daughters gave him a mask to wear at the plant, but 2 days later, he told his kids that a supervisor ordered him to take it off because it was creating unnecessary fears among plant workers. Peter, we're hearing this from a lot of meat processing plant workers.
Yeah, this is a snapshot in time, our piece, and we focused on what was going on in March at that plant, which is not a slaughterhouse per se. It's a packaging plant where they bring the slaughtered carcasses in for butchering and then package them and send them to Walmarts and other stores on the East Coast. And the mid-March timeframe that we wanted to look at was a period when workers started to get sick in this 1,000-worker Cargill plant in Pennsylvania, and by March 20th or so, dozens upon dozens were not coming to work, and rumors were spreading, and the management and the supervisors were telling the workers, well, there's one case here, we know that case there, but we have it under control. You have to come to work if you're feeling well. We're doing an essential service. People need to eat all the, you know, the prods. There's another aspect at that plant, which is true throughout all of the big meat packers, and that is they paid a bonus for workers to come in and work in that period. If you worked straight through from mid-March through May, you were going to get a $500 bonus, which is roughly a week's pay. And you were also, on top of that, getting two extra dollars per hour, so roughly $14, $15 an hour base, and you were going to get another $2, so $16 to $17 an hour. So there were lots of reasons to stay on the job if you could, not to mention, you know, you're not making a lot of money to begin with, and your family depends on it. So when this guy, Raphael Benjamin, who'd been there something like 17 years at this plant, which has an interesting history, and he sort of goes back to the whole history of that plant, but when Raphael was getting worried toward late March, I think it was March 25th, and had expressed concerns to his family members that people are sick in the plant, his daughter said, okay, here's a mask, Daddy, wear the mask. And he did wear the mask for 2 days until a supervisor said, no, you can't wear that. People are going to get too worried. We're trying to keep people on the job, not make them go home. and seeing you when they come in is not a good thing. So he did not wear the mask after that point, and it was but a week, which is significant because that's about the incubation period, or it includes the 4 or 5 day period of where they believe exposure can then lead to symptoms. Anyway, over the next week, he contracted the virus, and on around April 3rd, he was too sick to go in, and on April 7th, he went to the hospital, and he died April 19th after 12 days on a ventilator. Mm-hmm. During that period, he had his 17-year anniversary at Cargill, which entitled him to a higher pension, and that was a big goal for him. Obviously, he wanted to be working and healthy and not in the hospital dying, but he wanted to hit that 17-year milestone so he could retire. He had planned his retirement for the fall, and he was going to move to the South and be with some family members and then spend time in their home country of the Dominican Republic with other relatives, and he kind of had it all planned out and didn't make it.
Mm. Have you been in touch with his family since writing this piece?
Yeah, I was communicating with his son, who's a soldier in the Army and based at a cyber warfare center in Georgia. Obviously, they're extremely disturbed by what happened, a bit numb in the aftermath. His son, by the way, was coming up on his 20-year anniversary in the U.S. military and was planning to retire and spend some of that time with his parents. By the way, the mom, the widow of Rafael, who'd been married to him for 37 years, was also planning this retirement. So they were all looking forward to a kind of new era in the family's life, and that's not going to happen. I believe the son is still planning to retire from the military.
Wow. You report that after Rafael died on April 19th, the very next day, the plant reopened after a two-week cleaning.
Yeah, so it's interesting. It was the 7th of April when he went to the hospital that the plant closed. And he was in the hospital for the entire time. They were cleaning and installing these plexiglass barriers between workstations and doing other things they're hoping will hold down the disease. A day later, after his death on April 20th, it reopened and has been open ever since.
Another worker you spoke to, Annabelle, said her supervisor ignored her health complaints even though she had a cough and was sick. She told you, quote, "All my coworkers got sick." Can you talk, Peter, about the directives that were happening at the plants for people to just keep working?
Sure. So it's very clear. We interviewed 32 different workers from this Hazleton plant, so we had an unusually thorough perspective on what happened in this time frame. And it's very clear that at least the mid-level supervisors with whom they dealt about their condition and their work on the line and so forth, as well as members of the infirmary staff, were not taking symptoms very seriously in this period. Again, we're calling it the March period, which is earlier, by the way, than some of these other plants, and we can talk about that in a second. It has to do with its location 2 hours west of New York City. But anyway, they were not taking these symptoms very seriously, and if you came in and complained of COVID-like symptoms, including a cough or you're just not feeling well, you're feeling really tired, without a test and without a high fever, and I'll elaborate on that too, they said, no, go back to the line, go to the cafeteria where they had Tylenol, and go back to the line. And that happened to at least 10 people we spoke to among these 32. But the kind of eagerness, the determination to keep working in that plant and keep employees on the line was really quite surprising, given that, remember, we're talking mid-March when everybody else was headed home and sheltering in place if they could. Obviously not other essential workers, and many couldn't, but you know, most of us, particularly in the Bay Area, we're in our basements by mid-March or the 20th or so. And this is a time when Cargill, who, by the way, has operations in China, and by their own acknowledgement, was very familiar with the coronavirus for 6 to 8 weeks prior to this time period, when everybody knew better, yet they were still determined to have these workers on the line. And again, it goes back to one of the first things I said, which is, compared to the daily hazards and lopped off fingers and literally deaths from meat grinder that people experience in meat plants, this was seen as a relatively lightweight risk.
And yet, as you report, people died. You know, this brings me to a question about regulation, Peter, because with a government that is so focused on deregulation, like the Trump administration and some Democrats, you know, allowing these corporations to voluntarily embrace standards, for example, worker safety standards, it's just not going to happen, especially when you're talking about major, major profits, like a $1 billion corporation. So, you know, what was needed in this case was the federal government to implement rules, right? To say, look, if you have employees that work side by side, they have to be wearing masks.
Absolutely. And the whole mask thing is very interesting. So OSHA is primarily responsible at the federal level for health and safety of workers in factories. And OSHA, you know, regulates this cargo plant as they do almost every meatpacking plant. But I don't want to put the blame entirely on the Trump administration, because OSHA has been a pretty feckless agency almost from in the beginning. It is chronically underfunded. I think it has about the same or maybe even less funding than it did when it was founded, you know, decades ago. And its power to punish and to deter these things is also very, very weak when it comes to how large the companies are. Because as you implied there, the larger the revenue, the less significant a $10,000 fine is for having a worker lose a finger on the line, which is a routine number, maybe $15,000. I mean, these are not serious deterrents whatsoever. But in the case of COVID, it's even worse. And it's not just a Trump thing there either. Essentially, from our reporting, OSHA inspectors deserted their jobs in that time period, in the sense that they were not making plant inspections and checking up on the safety or health protection of the workers from COVID whatsoever. We have many cases in other plants, this isn't Cargill per se, where they would do a phone call with the plant management, because inspectors apparently do have they can go one of two ways when they get a complaint from a worker about a hazard or a danger in a plant. They can go out and inspect it, which they do in some cases, particularly for safety issues, if a machine is unguarded and people are actually getting hurt and so forth, or if there's been a serious injury, they will go out and look at the plant. But they can also pick up the phone and call the management and say, we have these complaints, can you please tell us what you're doing? And that's what they did in a number of instances when they got complaints, and people said to them, you know, workers were calling saying, you know, our brethren are leaving the line, our colleagues are leaving the line by the dozens, and they're not telling us how many people are sick, and we're coming to work, we don't know whether we should be here, they're doing very little to protect us, we're still shoulder to shoulder. And OSHA would call the plant management and say, hey, what are you doing to protect them? And they'd say, we're doing our best, we're staggering breaks, we're not letting them sit side by side in the lunchroom, doing all these things. And OSHA said, okay. So in the case of the Cargill plant where Rafael Benjamin died, OSHA never showed up. There were numerous complaints. There were local leaders calling OSHA for weeks and weeks. They never came, nor did the state health inspectors come from Pennsylvania, which is a little surprising in a state like that, where there's lots of industry and some level of responsiveness by the government. But in any case, no health inspections. Finally, local townships, including Hazleton and others in the area, organized their code inspectors, the people who might, you know, go to a health plant if there's been an outbreak of some kind of digestive disease or something else, or, you know, the health inspectors would, you know, organize and were doing plant visits, because there are a lot of these kinds of food processing and warehousing plants in that area. And they never made it to Cargill. I don't have an exact reason why. So Cargill was not even inspected by the local health inspectors in Hazleton. We do know from one of the government people who tried to organize the local inspections that they did put a call into Cargill and never heard back in the time frame we're talking about. So no government inspection at all of this Cargill plant.
Peter, we have about a minute left. I want to ask you a question that a number of listeners wrote in about yesterday. What will it take? I mean, this is a very big question. We can do an entire hour on this, but given you've done a lot of reporting, what will it take to change this, to ensure that workers live, work in a safe environment?
Two things. First, as exists now, there's a culture of impunity that surrounds these companies. They're so large, they have so much political influence. The counties, particularly poor parts of the United States, bend over backwards, pay huge inducements for them to come in, tax abatements and the like, which they did in Pennsylvania. I think the local school district in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, lost $1 million a year for quite a poor area because of the tax abatements they gave Cargill to build their meat plant. So there's just a disproportionate power in their hands, and as I said, a culture of impunity. When people, as one plant we're writing about in Texas, where people's fingers, the JBS plant, they've had something like more than a dozen amputations just in the last 24 months. The largest fine from OSHA was $10,000 for JBS in that plant.
Well, Peter, sorry to cut you off, but we are out of time. We will definitely have you back to discuss this further. Peter Waldman is an award-winning reporter for Bloomberg. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar.